Well, welcome to our first oral argument of the term. I want to remind you that at 11 o'clock, there's going to be a fire alarm. Nobody needs to leave. I always jump when they do this, even though I know it's coming. So just because I'm jumping, don't get nervous. It's just me. It scares me every time. So I have never gotten used to it. But I remind you, and if you're here now, you may be on your way, and we may be all finished, and you may not be in the room or anywhere around. So I will remind us all, but our law clerks are here, and I don't know if they're jumpers or not, but we will find out since it's the first case of the term. Okay, so I'll call our first case, State versus Anderson. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jay Pusick.
Just a minute, counsel. I'm not hearing you. There's some problem with the mic. Tina, can you fix it for him? Try again.
Good morning.
That's better. That's okay. Better. Does he need to raise it just a bit? Thank you, Tina. Okay.
Good morning.
Very good. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jay Pusick, and I represent Roy Anderson. I'll be addressing two issues in this case today. First, what quantum of evidence must an officer possess before subjecting someone to a search under Act 79, and whether or not that standard was met in this case? And second, whether the officer in this case had reasonable suspicion to believe that Mr. Anderson was committing a crime. 2013 Wisconsin Act 79 created multiple statutes which authorize the search of the person, home, and belongings of people that are on various specific forms of community supervision without a warrant and based solely on reasonable suspicion. What the statute leaves unclear is what quantum of evidence an officer must possess before subjecting someone to a search under this statute. No Wisconsin cases directly address this question, but other state and federal courts have addressed similar questions. Many of those courts...
Counsel, and by quantum of evidence, you're referring to the evidence necessary to establish that the individual was subject to...
Wait. That is correct.
Okay.
I didn't hear the end of that.
To Act 79.
Okay, thank you.
Should I bring it closer?
I was told not to talk into the microphones directly, so
no, you're doing fine.
Apparently you can now. Other state and federal courts have addressed similar questions, and many of those courts have determined that an officer simply needs to know that a person is not only on supervision, but subject to a reduced search standard as a result.
Okay, and what does it mean to know, though? Isn't that the question? Because I agree that as a policy matter, it seems to make sense that an officer would check, right, to
correct.
See if there, but is it enough? Do you know if you know the person was just put on probation and it's a few months later and it was a felony? Like, is that enough knowledge?
Well, I think if the officer can say that I checked and I know that they are on a form of supervision that would subject them to Act 79, whatever the factual predicates that those may be, and they know that that supervision is current at the time that the search is conducted, I think it's as simple as that.
So you're equating knowledge with checking. So there's no circumstance under which a person could be searched without an officer actually, in your mind, without an officer actually verifying that they're still on supervision?
I think that it is good policy.
Well, it is good policy,
to require the contemporaneous check. But I'm not arguing that they have to do a check in every single case, no matter what.
So why didn't they have to do it? Why did they have to do a check here?
I don't know that I'm arguing that they did. What I'm saying is that the officer didn't have the knowledge that was required here. What he testified to and the evidence that we have from him about what he knew is insufficient.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, where does the requirement that he know the individual subject to Act 79 come from? Is that statutory? Is that constitutional? What is the source of that?
I think it's clearly not statutory. The statute doesn't address it. I think it's under the Fourth Amendment, and my argument specifically is rooted in the cases that I've cited in the brief.
So what's your best case to establish that as a constitutional matter, the officer must know that the individual is subject to Act 79?
So in United States versus Williams, it's a federal district court case. In that case, the police conducted a search of a parolee's residence. And in that case, the police knew. They did know that that person was on parole. It was the state of Illinois where a reduced search condition is mandatory as part of parole in that state. And yet the federal district court concluded that the search was illegal because the officers didn't know enough.
Do you have any cases that are authoritative with respect to our court?
No, I didn't cite any cases that are from the U.S. Supreme. Obviously, as I mentioned, there's no cases from this court on that point.
But doesn't the argument that you advance, that a defendant must know, merely beg the question of to what quantum? No to a certainty, no to a objectively reasonable belief. So the argument that a defendant must know leaves me wanting more. What's your answer for the more?
So I think the difficulty here and something that I think I've struggled with and the difficulty is that this question that's presented in this case is very different than the traditional Fourth Amendment question. In the traditional case, what you have is starting position of taking what the officers know, right? All the cases talk about starting at that point. What did the officers know at the time? So clearly there is some idea of what it means to know. And then you move from that, taking those facts, moving into deciding whether or not they create a reasonable suspicion or a reasonable belief of some sort of ambiguous fact.
Objectively reasonable belief?
Correct. That's the normal process in a Fourth Amendment analysis. And so that process is taking a set of known facts, and those facts are ambiguous by their very nature. And really, oftentimes, there's no way of knowing exactly what they mean for sure in the moment. And so the courts, in order to analyze whether or not police action is appropriate in those circumstances, you've got to have a standard by which to judge it. And so it's judged by whether or not, based on the known facts, whether or not their actions were reasonable. I don't think that's the case here. I don't think it's that complicated. We don't need to move on to the whether or not the action is reasonable. We can stop at what they know.
Let's look at what they knew. And if I recall, in your reply brief, here's a fancy legal term, poo-poo, or downplay, the check of the record that the officer did here. Officer Seeger, I think, testified as set forth on page 5 of your reply brief and other places, the following sentence. I did a record check of him and knew that he felony under Act 79. And you posit that that's nonsensical.
Correct.
And that it's not enough to establish that the officer had the requisite knowledge.
Correct.
Does this case, in part, then just boil down to you think it's a nonsensical sentence that gives you no information? Others might say, well, okay, there's a little grammar problem there, but it starts out, I did a record check of him. If you're talking about facts, historical facts, and some people might think it's a reasonable interpretation to say that although grammatically a problem,
A reasonable interpretation of the remaining part of the sentence is that he knew, to use your language, knew, that he was a felon subject to Act 79. Why is that not a reasonable interpretation?
Well, as I pointed out in the brief, the first part of that, let me break it down. The first part of that sentence does make sense. I did a record check, so we know that. But as I pointed out, and I think it's an important thing to note here, whatever record check he did clearly wasn't sufficient enough to let him know that Mr. Anderson was on extended supervision. The officer believed that he was on probation. And so that we already have some, bless you, we already have some idea that whatever check was done clearly wasn't sufficient. And so you move into the second clause, and I don't think it is a reasonable interpretation of that clause to say that it means the officer knew that there was a felony. It doesn't make any sense in that kind of, in that reading. I knew that he felony under Act 79. I don't think you can, you would have to add an entire clause to that sentence in order to give it the meaning that the state argues for.
Well, counsel, I'm not entirely sure why the officer needs to know at all whether the individual is subject to Act 79. His status is either he is or he isn't. Right?
Correct.
So let's change the situation just a little bit. So there are types of businesses that are subject to regular inspections because of the nature of the business, right?
Correct.
And there's a lower Fourth Amendment standard for conducting a search under those circumstances. Let's say it's a weapons manufacturer. If an individual authorized to inspect weapons manufacturers were to go to an establishment to conduct such a search and inspection, would we ever inquire into what the individual's knowledge was about what a weapons manufacturing establishment or not? Or would we simply ask, is it or is it not? If it is, you have a lower Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy. If it's not, it's higher, and you simply judge the search under that rubric.
Well, I haven't, to be honest, I haven't done any specific research into that area of the law in preparation. Off the cuff, I would say I think it is important to know that the area that they're searching before the search subjects whatever they're searching to a lower search requirement.
And if we were to have a case like that, would we be inquiring? Would we actually inquire, officer, did you know that it was a weapons manufacturing plant?
If that was an issue in the case, I would think you would have to.
Would that bear on the constitutionality of the search if he didn't know? So, for example, let's say he thought that it manufactured swimming pool equipment, and he goes and he does the search. And then it turns out that it actually is a weapons manufacturing plant, and the Constitution says you have a lower expectation of privacy. Would we say that search was unconstitutional because of the officer's state of mind?
I would think so. I think it's a little bit of a different scenario than what we have here, though, where you have an officer searching a private citizen on public streets.
Yeah, what I'm getting at, though, is they're both status elements, right?
Sure.
You either have a business establishment that entitles you to a lowered expectation of privacy. That's based your status. And here, Mr. Anderson's status is that he has a lower expectation of privacy as a matter of constitutional and statutory law.
Right.
It is lower. So why would the officer's understanding of what that individual's expectation of privacy is affect whether the search is constitutional?
Well, I think, again, if you go back to the cases that are cited, other states have certainly wrestled with this before, where people have a parole search condition or something akin to Act 79, and that analysis isn't done in those cases. If you look, all of them talk about simply what the officer knows and the requirement that they have to know, and that's very clear in the cases, even though many of those cases are a little bit factually different from what we have here. The cases universally say the officers have to know or be aware of this condition before they engage in the search. It's not a situation where I mean, I think those arguments were advanced in many of those cases.
Yeah, let me try it this way. When the legislature passed Act 79, it lowered the individual's expectation of privacy, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So an individual walking around the state, around the streets, who is subject to Act 79, we know that he has a lower expectation of privacy, correct?
I think you could argue it that way. I don't know that the cases look at it from that light. I think you're looking at it from the reasonableness of what the officer's actions are.
Okay. Yeah, got it. I want to kind of reverse engineer this, though. Right. So is there any reason for us to doubt that Mr. Anderson actually had, constitutionally and statutorily, a reduced expectation of privacy because he was subject to Act 79? Is there any reason to doubt that?
No.
Okay. Now, does his expectation of privacy depend on what an officer might know about his status?
No.
Why do we care what the officer knew when he searched Mr. Anderson?
Because this court's duty here is to evaluate the police conduct, right? If we're going to allow officers to search people without a warrant in a way that would be unconstitutional otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Let me just stop you right there. So Mr. Anderson, in fact, was subject to Act 79.
Yes.
And so from a constitutional statutory standpoint, the officer's conduct was perfectly acceptable.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of what actually happened, mm-hmm. but, of course, it depends, whether or not what he did is okay depends on what his level of knowledge was. Even if this court wanted to hold that he had to have a reasonable belief as to Mr. Anderson's being subject to Act 79, I think on this record, you look at what Officer Anderson knew, and this record doesn't even satisfy that particular standard.
Counsel, just to pick up on that a little bit, I mean, we do have some cases that address these sorts of issues. In Rowan, we held that in a condition of extended supervision, allowing a search for any time, for any reason, was permissible. And we relied largely on Griffin and Sampson, right?
Correct.
Griffin, the U.S. Supreme Court, affirmed us saying probation agents can search based on reasonable grounds. Sampson, we say that a statutory suspicionless search of parolees, which is something very much like our extended supervision,
correct,
that you can do that constitutionally. And so it seems to me what we have here is the legislature doing something very similar to what's been approved, except actually providing a higher threshold. Here you have to have reasonable suspicion, and there's additional protections the legislature has put in there. It needs to not be arbitrary, capricious, or harassing. It needs to be done reasonably, right? You pulled in this "what do we need to know" question, and it's based on this idea of, generally speaking, is there a Fourth Amendment question here? And it seems that the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken at least fairly authoritatively and said that we're not really in the ground where you have significant problems with the legislature establishing this type of thing as an issue, where we need to establish another threshold beyond what the statute already says.
Correct. And I would direct you back to, and the court back to, United States versus Williams, where the federal district judge found that even the officer's knowledge, simply that the defendant in that case was on parole in a state where a search condition is mandatory as part of that parole, was not enough knowledge for the officer, and the search was thus illegal. The court held that not only did the officer have to know that the defendant was on parole, but also that his particular parole had this search condition, even though it was almost certainly did. And so, and of course, that case is rooted in the Fourth Amendment. And so I think that as persuasive authority, the reasoning in Williams sort of addresses that a little bit, and I think is something that this court should consider and look to.
Before we run out of time, will you also address the second piece of this, which is even if we get past the knowledge part and find that the officer had enough knowledge here, or that knowledge isn't required, or however you get there, what about the circumstances surrounding the search and whether the officer reasonably suspected that Anderson was committing, about to commit, or had committed a crime? Can you touch on that, please?
Thank you. I will. Looking at the reasonable suspicion analysis in this case, the evidence can really be broken down into two categories, and I think they need to be addressed separately. The first category is the tips that Officer Seeger claimed that he received about Mr. Anderson, and the second would be his observations on the day of the search. With regard to the tips, we know from the case law very clearly that officers may rely on tips to form the basis of reasonable suspicion if those tips are reliable. In analyzing the reliability of the tips, the officer and the court, in reviewing the actions of the officer, looks to the informant's veracity and their basis of knowledge. And, of course, we also know that in cases where there's no evidence about that, like in an anonymous tip case, if there are sufficient details to indicate insider knowledge and the police are able to corroborate a significant number of predictive facts from that tip, that would also
right.
be
right. So we don't have any of that here. The tips alone are not enough.
Correct.
But can you combine the tips with the rest of it and say that that's altogether enough? Totality
no.
of the circumstances. Tell me why not.
Because the tip, whether or not a tip is reliable is sort of it's an all or nothing question. If the tip isn't reliable, how is it that it can be used for anything of value? Especially in this case where we have no evidence of its reliability. We know nothing about the informant or their veracity. We know nothing about their basis of knowledge.
Can the fact that the officer knew about the defendant's prior drug dealing activity, can that corroborate the tip because it's consistent with the defendant's prior criminal activity?
No, I don't think so. Again, in a case like this where there's just nothing here upon which to hang your hat to find that this tip was reliable. We simply have that conclusory statement from the officer that it was a reliable and credible confidential informant. We know from Mansfield that that's not enough.
Counsel, just to make sure I understand your position, is that essentially if you have a confidential informants that are, we don't have evidence of the record that they are substantiated in substantial measure, but we don't include those in the ordinary kind of totality of the circumstances analysis for our purposes here.
Yes.
I think there's an alternative reading of our cases, which would be that we might discount those as relevant factors, but that they're still part of the totality of the circumstances analysis as well, that just because information might not be demonstrated as inherently reliable, we might still consider it. It just might be of low value when we conduct the analysis.
Well, I don't see that analysis. I know that the state cites State versus Miller in support of that proposition. I don't read Miller that way. Miller is a case where you have a number of tips. They're all of the same character. And in Miller, my reading of it is that the basis for upholding reasonable suspicion in that case is the fact that the final tip was of good enough reliability based on the informant essentially giving identifying information and risking identifying themselves and giving a large number of details, many of which were corroborated by the police. And so there's the comment at the end of Miller where they say, well, you know, this final tip was good enough. And this court said, well, you know, and also the officer could consider those earlier tips in deciding whether or not their reasonable suspicion was enough on the final tip.
Why would we throw it out, though? Why would we? I mean, there's all sorts of information when you're conducting a, you know, totality of the circumstances analysis that is not particularly helpful. Maybe it's a high crime area. Maybe it's 7 o'clock at night versus 5 o'clock, and there's all sorts of judgment calls you make. And you throw it into the pot, and right, we have to make a judgment call of whether there be there. Why would we throw out certain pieces of evidence, even evidence that we might not find particularly probative?
Because no attempt to substantiate the credibility of this informant was made in this case. And I would point the court to this court's decision in State versus Hogan, where the police were looking at whether or not there was reasonable suspicion to extend a traffic stop beyond its initial scope. And part of the reasonable suspicion analysis in that case was information from an informant that an officer had that the defendant was a meth cook. And that was part of the record. The officer testified that there was this confidential informant that the defendant was a meth cook. And yet this court stated that that's not enough. The court has to be able to look at the factors that support reliability and analyze whether or not those are reasonable. We can't just rely on what the officer says. And the court said specifically in closing out the discussion of reasonable suspicion in this tip, quote, the state's failure to tie up loose ends in the circuit court should not be rewarded. And I think that's the case here as well. Who knows whether or not these tips were, they may very well have been reliable, but this court has to have that information. The state needs to do at least the bare minimum to establish that this confidential informant was reliable in some way. And none of that was done here. And so because you don't have any kind of no attempt, there's no information upon which we can find that they're reliable and credible. I would note that in Miller, at least some of those tips do have some indicia of reliability. The first tipster was identified. And so those tips in that case at least had some value. In this case, there's no value to this tip. And I can't stress that point enough here, that with no value, and I see that my red light is on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You might want to adjust the mic a little bit when you begin, because you're a little bit shorter.
Okay. How does that sound?
That's pretty good.
Okay. Let me know. I tend to get quiet, too, so please let me know. May it please the Court, Sarah Burgundy representing the state in this case. Before I get started, I just wanted to address the point counsel was making on issue two about taking the tips out of the totality of the circumstances analysis. There's no authority providing that tips just disappear from the analysis. It's not an all or nothing situation. Reliability is a continuum, and if a tip is extraordinarily reliable, you need less evidence, less surrounding evidence to support it. If it's lower on the reliability scale, you still look at it in context of the other evidence.
What sufficient indicia of reliability attends to the tip in this case?
Well, so Officer Seeger described the informant as it was a confidential informant, so...
Confidential and reliable, but we
yes.
go underneath that. So what's beyond that?
Beyond that, the tip was received recently within 2.5 weeks. First encounter with Mr. Anderson. He had a history with Mr. Anderson, having arrested him in the past for a felony drug crime. He was aware that he was on probation. Or I'm sorry, I'm using the wrong word too. He was aware that he was on extended supervision for that crime beginning March 2015. The tip indicated that Mr. Anderson was selling drugs in an alleyway behind a particular address, and that's where he saw Mr. Anderson. Mr. Anderson responded in a way that, in his experience, was consistent with drug dealing or trying to hide something. He biked away from him. He darted down an alley. He was looking behind his shoulder to see where the officer was.
The alley was behind Anderson's house, though, so it wasn't really surprising to find him there.
It wasn't surprising to find him there, but it was significant that the informant said it is this alley behind his residence where this is happening. So this wasn't a situation where Mr. Anderson's walking through the front door of the residence with a gym bag, or he's driving his car from the residence. He was actually engaging in an activity in the alley behind the residence and sort of,
and biking.
And Officer Anderson also said I'd seen him hanging out there, so just this sort of...
But again, it's behind his house. I mean, individually,
sure.
That to me is not significant. What I'm more interested in is the question that I posed to counsel for Mr. Anderson, which is, can the tip be corroborated in a sense by the officer's prior knowledge and actual knowledge of Anderson's drug dealing activity, because the record regarding the tip and the tipster here is really sparse. I mean, you would agree, I think, that the prosecutor should have asked more questions at the hearing to establish the reliability of the tip. But I'm, again, looking at the totality of the circumstances, so can we consider as part of the totality analysis the fact that this officer knew this man and his prior drug dealing activity?
Yes, I think it definitely, I think to say it corroborates the tip might be the wrong word, but I think it strengthens Officer Speaker's belief in the reliability of the tip, or kind of, you know, it explains Officer Seeger's reaction to it. It might explain why he maybe didn't have a more detailed explanation of why he believed the tip was reliable, because this is someone, I've had a history with this person. I know he dealt drugs in the past. I know he was convicted for dealing cocaine, and I was told that twice within the last 2 weeks that he is doing the same thing that I arrested him for several years ago.
So once a drug dealer, always a drug dealer for purposes of an officer's corroboration of a tip?
I don't think it turns it into a reliable tip that can serve as itself as the only basis.
But you're saying it falls into totality of the circumstances.
It doesn't turn this, you know, but the tip isn't just nothing.
So besides the tip, though, what do we have? We've got a guy who's biking down a sidewalk who sees an officer. The officer doesn't try to stop him, and he happens to look over his shoulder, which I don't know, a lot of people would do, right, because they see an officer. He puts his hand in his pocket. It's a high crime area, which happens to be where he lives. I mean, tell me what else, if we do go along with what's being argued in terms of taking out the tip or saying that there's nothing reliable about this tip, what else is there in the totality of the circumstances?
Well, I think you have to take in Officer Seeger's experience with Anderson in the past. Anderson knows his officers. His officer's in a marked squad. He knows Officer Seeger.
Okay.
If he sees him, he changes directions. He's looking behind him. He's putting his hand in his pocket. And it's, you know, I think we're kind of going into, like, the Terry analysis. If you take each part, as the defendant does, and say, well, this has an innocent explanation, that has an innocent explanation, but taking together this history, this recent information that Anderson is doing the thing he was actually doing at the time, and his reactions to Officer Seeger when Officer Seeger came up behind, was following him. And I do want to correct that Officer Seeger did tell Anderson to stop, and Anderson didn't stop. This wasn't in the testimony, but it was in the criminal complaint that...
Is that part of the record? Because I don't know that that's something we can rely on if it's not.
You can... when the court's doing an analysis of, or checking the reliability or the reasonableness of the reasonable suspicion, you can... If the court made the finding, the court made that finding that the officer said stop and he didn't, and that has support in the criminal complaint.
The court made the finding when?
At the hearing.
So it's in the transcript? If you can point me to the transcript page, I think that's helpful.
This is in the record transcript 24, page 26. I should have brought my readers. Page 134 in the appendix. About line 11, the officer testified it's a high drug area. I'm sorry, it's around line 7, and they followed him. And not only did he put his hand in the pocket, but he kept riding until he was verbally instructed to stop. Even though he saw the police behind him, he made no effort to stop.
Right, so he wasn't told to stop. Why would he make an effort to stop just because he sees the police
behind him? He was verbally instructed to stop.
I don't get that out of what you just read. I get that he stopped once he was told to stop.
Read it again.
Okay. And not only did he put his hand in his pocket, but he kept writing until he was verbally instructed to stop. Even though he saw the police behind him, he made no effort to stop.
Okay, so he stopped after he was told. I think that's Justice Dallet's.
Okay, I just want to make sure we're not adding something in, because
the larger point, he was told to stop.
And he stopped.
Well, after...
After he was told to stop.
I think, yeah, the finding is he wasn't, I don't think the finding, the finding is he was riding until he was verbally instructed to stop, but when you look at the criminal complaint, it says he didn't stop immediately. So,
okay.
And the whole thing was probably a matter of a few seconds, so, but I just wanted to clarify there was a command to stop in there.
To use a tip, does there have to be corroboration under our case law?
It depends on, well, it first depends on whether the tip's anonymous, citizen, or confidential. Whether the reliability to start with also depends on largely the information that the informant gives the officer about themselves. So
the tip that was given here by a confidential informant, does it have to be corroborated?
Corroboration helps.
But it's not necessary to be corroborated?
If this, well, I think if the surrounding circumstances, I think the surrounding circumstances can corroborate. I mean, I guess what, and I'm probably placing too narrow a definition on corroborate in terms of, you know.
Yeah, maybe you are. And the reason I ask this question is a follow-up of a prior question asked by my colleague. And she specifically asked, can we consider what the officer knew about the defendant's prior drug activity as corroboration of the tip? And you equivocated. And you said, well, not corroboration, which causes my question. Doesn't the confidential informant tip need corroboration? And if the knowledge of the officer about the defendant's prior drug activity is not corroboration, what serves as corroboration here?
I think, well, and perhaps I was overthinking the corroboration question because is the officer's history of the defendant has to inform it. I mean, I think that has to go into, you know, Mr. Anderson has engaged in this behavior before. The officer is aware of it. And so when you receive a tip, you can't expect the officer to say, well, I'm just going to start from a clean slate and you know, go from A to B to C to corroborate that, you know, whether this is happening. In this case, he did see the you know, again, he saw Anderson in that area before this event and at the August arrest. So I think, yeah, I think it does have to corroborate it, and I think the surrounding circumstances in terms of the interaction corroborates it, too.
Corroborates the reliability of the
corroborates the reliability, and I think that that's what I was getting at, and I perhaps was too narrowly suggesting that corroboration means, you know, corroborating this particular fact and that particular fact. But what, you know, talking about corroboration and reliability of tips, in, you know, White v. Alabama, the Supreme Court teaches that when an officer can corroborate innocent details, when an informant's correct about innocent details, that goes toward corroborating the reliability of the tip itself and increases its reliability in the mix of the totality of the circumstances. So.
Do you agree that without the tip, if we did take the tip out of the equation because it wasn't corroborated, that there's not enough here to stop Mr. Anderson, or would you think that there is?
Certainly closer, but I think there's still, well, I think it would be a closer case for sure.
So that means maybe?
Maybe, but there's no circumstance where we would take the tip out of the equation. So, and there's no, I mean, I looked for case law where courts, you know, had a tip available and they were doing a totality of the circumstances analysis. I couldn't find a single example or any authority for the proposition that if the tip isn't entirely corroborated or falls lower on the reliability scale that you just pretend that it's not there. So, shifting to the first question, I wanted to address Justice Kelly and Justice Hagedorn's questions about what's required, where do we get this requirement that law enforcement knows. And I I kind of want to take a step back, and I think the counsel's sort of placing this heightened definition, into the equation. I think the officer needs to have a reasonable belief that the person is subject to Act 79. That's the state's position. But and whether you use that the term reasonable belief or no or was aware, it all means the same thing. And I think counsel is trying to move toward this, toward a beyond a reasonable doubt standard or this absolute certainty standard, which isn't present anywhere in Fourth Amendment law jurisprudence.
Where do you get the requirement that the officer have a reasonable belief that the individual is subject to Act 79?
That comes from, and that's a great question because it isn't actually clear. But I think the generally Fourth Amendment law requires any action by law enforcement requires is a reasonableness question. And so.
Right. But that's generally what we're pursuing when we make that inquiry is do the facts measure up to the standard,
mm-hmm.
right? So, if we're in an exigent circumstances kind of analysis, we look at the facts and we say, what did the officer reasonably believe about the circumstances? And we figure out, okay, does that meet exigent circumstances? Here, the circumstances are simply that it's a person subject to Act 79. And he's subject to Act 79 without regard to whether the officer believes he is or not,
mm-hmm.
right? And that lowers his expectation of privacy. So why do we care about the officer's subjective knowledge about whether he's subject to Act 79?
Well, because within this question is the reasonableness of his action in doing the search. And so for someone under Act 79, it's not only that an officer can search if there's reasonable suspicion of a crime, but the person has to be subject to the act. And so when you're looking at the reasonableness of the search, I don't think I don't think you could say, that was a reasonable search, even though the officer – so say an officer just stops someone that they have reason – they do a Terry stop, they have reasonable suspicion of a crime, and they say, I'm just going to go ahead and search you. I'm not going to do any – checking. I think it would be difficult to argue that wasn't an arbitrary search in that case.
Well, counsel, doesn't the statute address that very thing? And it seems to me that analytically what you're doing is proposing an initial threshold determination that all of a sudden would now be a part of any search challenged under this, whereas the statute seems to do the reverse. The statute seems to say if you're subject to Act 79, that there needs to be reasonable suspicion. But there's essentially defense that's laid out here. It needs to be done in a reasonable manner, and it cannot be arbitrary, capricious, or harassing. So the statute doesn't seem to impose it as an initial, what did the officer know? The question is, in your example, I think you're right. That would be an example of something that's arbitrary. You can't just pick somebody out and say, I don't like this guy, I don't like this person, we're just going to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
The statute explicitly says you can't do that.
Right.
And the statute addresses that, though. Again, the United States Supreme Court has said a suspicionless search of anybody who's, on parole is acceptable and doesn't raise a Fourth Amendment question. Again, California passing that law and the United States Supreme Court overcoming it. So I don't understand why we're bringing an additional Fourth Amendment inquiry that the statute doesn't support analytically.
Sure. And I completely follow the reasoning and the logic of it. I can tell you that every time that's been argued in any court, it's more or less either been rejected. There was one court, there's a court in California that accepted that reasoning, and there was after that kind of this kumbaya moment among commentators and other courts saying that's not right, basically. If that's I'm in the position basically of saying, I get that reasoning, but it in all of the cases I looked at, every court that's kind of considered these sort of questions has said that the reasonableness of the search has to depend on the officer being aware of the status, because it is, and whether it falls into this kind of line of special needs cases where it's, you know.
It felt like most of the cases that you were citing and even the California case, you know, which I read, where they essentially borrow on this totally different analytical inquiry, which is an officer doesn't have legal authority but thinks he does. Mm-hmm. And so what are we going to do in that situation? But there's a big difference between saying the officer doesn't have legal authority, what do we do with that, and suppressing evidence because the officer does have legal authority
right.
to do the search. Those are very different things.
They are, and you know, and all I can say is, you know, and it sort of sounds like almost just a standing question, does, you know, if someone is subject to Act 79, would they have standing to challenge the officer's knowledge of the search? And all I can say is we didn't raise that argument, and if, you know, if the court would like further briefing on it, we could provide it. But based on my initial research and preparing for argument, it was not something that seemed accepted.
Do we do this in any other context? For example, the heavily regulated industries. Do we require the inspector to subjectively know the place that he's going to inspect is subject to a lowered expectation of privacy?
I'm not aware of any, but I also did not research that very thoroughly. So,
with respect to these circumstances, though, the Fourth Amendment cases, isn't the typical case involving these types of statutes one where it's a probation officer doing the search, and therefore they do have knowledge, and maybe the court didn't address the amount because it was very clear that, I mean, isn't that typically in these types of situations what we see?
Most of the time, the knowledge is there. You're right. But there are cases where it is this sort of middle ground. So, I mean, you have these lines of cases, the officer has no idea, and it's search, they do the search. They have situations where they definitely know.
And it's your assessment that in all the cases you've read that there is a quantum of knowledge required, or at least this reasonable belief.
The reasonable belief.
Reasonable
yes.
belief.
And so the one case I cite in my brief, People v. Douglas out of California, talks about that sort of situation, that middle ground situation where and it is a lot of parallels here. The officer arrested the defendant for the crime for which he was serving. He was aware that he was on supervision. He had last checked 2 months prior to his later arrest. And that was basically reasonable belief. And that was actually a lot, you know, the facts of that case were a lot closer because, as it turned out, the defendant was really only 3 days away from release at the time of the arrest, but that was still, you know, the court found under the circumstances that was still reasonable belief supporting search.
To so. Justice Dalit's question, these are relatively new statutes, right? I mean, you know, this was essentially law enforcement saying, hey, probation agents get to do this stuff. We want the authority to do it, too. It'll help keep our streets safe. So they work with the legislature. They pass this law. And so it seems that these laws are actually of relatively recent vintage, and there isn't much case law. I mean, in my research, it seemed like almost everything dealt with the probation context as well.
It's relatively recent. And Sampson and Knights were 2000s. You know, this became law in 2013. There's a lot of really variation between the statutes and the laws in the state. So for example, in the case Williams that opposing counsel cites, has a very different structure. The operation of the law, it's unlike Wisconsin's, where by operation of just having it in the statute, the defendant, somebody on paper is on notice that they're subject to search with reasonable suspicion. In Illinois, even though it was a mandatory provision to go into probation, it's still, by the operation of it, it had to go into the probation agreement or the parole agreement. So there they had these other layers of awareness that were required because, you know, not everyone would be on the right kind of parole. Not everyone would necessarily have the agreement, or if there was an error where the agreement wasn't, or where the provision wasn't in the parole agreement, that could change it. So, you know, that case is a little not particularly applicable here.
The reasonable knowledge requirement, is that to protect, is that for the purpose of us policing police behavior, or is it to vindicate constitutional rights?
So the reasonable belief, I mean, it's kind of like any of the reasonableness requirements in the Fourth Amendment law that, yes, it's a little bit of both. It is protecting rights and it's watching the conduct.
Would it be possible to violate Mr. Anderson's constitutional rights under these circumstances simply because if we assume the officer did not know he was subject to Act 79, would Mr. Anderson's constitutional rights have been violated?
So assuming going on the fact that he is subject, so he's subject to Act 79 and the officer didn't know, would his constitutional rights be violated?
Right.
I think that would open up a question that's an open question, yes, because if he's already subject to the Act.
So he's subject to the Act, let's take as a given that the officer had reasonable suspicion of criminal activity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How would it be possible for him to violate Mr. Anderson's constitutional rights by the search?
And this would probably be an argument that, defense counsel might be interested in taking. But I guess the argument would be, even though I have a lower expectation of privacy in the search, a lower interest, I still have a reasonable expectation that the officer searching me is doing it with a non-arbitrary search, has a reasonable belief to support the search and is doing the search reasonably. So, and because it's so hard to separate out the reasonable, when you're doing a reasonableness of the officer's action deciding to search, it's difficult to separate out what the officer knew about the person to begin with. Especially when you have a statute like this that does take a smaller category of people in the general population and says you're subject to this lesser requirement. I don't know if I have a lot more to talk about unless you have more questions, but I think on both questions, though, we do meet the reasonableness requirement. Both Officer Seeger had a reasonable belief of that Anderson was subject to Act 79, and he was, in fact, subject to it. And under the totality of the circumstances, there was reasonable suspicion to search. Thank you.
Thank you.
You may want to readjust the microphone before you begin. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I want to address briefly first the reasonable suspicion question and talk about this tip issue. And there was questions about whether or not there was a statement about tips being on a continuum, and of course that's true. The problem is that in this case the state failed to even place this tip on the continuum. We know nothing about it. For example, it's certainly possible based on this record that the tip was from somebody who heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody. What's the reliability of that? It's a possible, based on this record, that the tipster knew Mr. Anderson and thought to himself or herself, boy, I know he sold drugs in the past, I think he'll do it again, without any basis of knowledge for that, guessed at it and told Officer Seeger that. That's possible. What's the reliability of that tip? The answer, of course, is that there's no reliability in those scenarios. And if that were the record that we had, the court certainly would conclude that that the tip is worth nothing. And that's the case that we have here because we know nothing about it. In terms of authority for discounting a tip that has no bolstering of the reliability or evidence of the reliability, this court's decision in Hogan does that, where the tip was completely discounted in the reasonable suspicion analysis because the state, quote, failed to tie up loose ends. And that's the case that we have here. We have no evidence. If the evidence existed, the state certainly could have put it on. They didn't do that, and so we have no ability to rely on this tip.
I haven't been able to find a case that says that the officer's prior knowledge of the defendant and his prior criminal activity can be used as part of the totality of the circumstances test, but it seems that some cases have, in fact, incorporated that into their analysis. I'm looking at State v. Miller in its analysis of State v. Richardson. It's paragraph 39 of the decision, and the court said the officer had no knowledge of Richardson or any planned drug sales before speaking with an anonymous caller. So in the context of an anonymous tip, which our cases tell us has less reliability, it appears that the court did take that into account.
And I think I think I have a handle on the question, but if I don't, let me know. I think the difference in Miller from this case is that the tips in Miller, we had evidence about them, we knew about them, and they maybe had, they were on that continuum. They had some value, even if it wasn't enough to support reasonable suspicion on its own. The problem here in this case is we have nothing, we know nothing about these tips.
So the officer's prior knowledge of Anderson in this case cannot put the tip back on the continuum, is your position?
Correct. Okay, I'm going to move along to talking about the observations, and of course, here we had the discussion about whether or not Mr. Anderson was told to stop. I just want to make that clear. The testimony on page 121 of the appendix, page 13 of document 24 in the index, is very clear. The question on line 9 from the defense counsel was, he made one turn, and when you caught up with him and told him to stop, he did, and Officer Seeger's answer was correct.
And can I even add something to that? I think there was a mention of him turning around and going a different direction. We don't even have evidence of that, right? He just turned and he's going toward his house,
correct?
Right?
Correct.
Okay, so he's just riding his bike and turning in a normal course.
Right, and he's in a high drug crime area. And
where he lives.
Right, where he lives. He puts his hand in his pocket and he looks over his shoulder. I would argue, and I know the courts looked at the Court of Appeals decision in Gordon, I would argue that Gordon presented a far more compelling case for reasonable suspicion, given that the high crime area was violent crime, that Gordon's touch of the pocket was particularly indicative of carrying a weapon, and the fact that Gordon appeared to be nervous to the officer. And so, and of course, the Court of Appeals found that that wasn't even enough for reasonable suspicion. That is my position there, that based on the observations, even adding in Officer Seeger's knowledge, it's not enough for reasonable suspicion. Moving along or back to the first issue, I just wanted to make a couple of points. With regard to the lower expectation of privacy that has been discussed, I think we're getting into the discussion about the policy purposes behind the exclusionary rule. Ignoring the officer's knowledge or lack of knowledge, whether it be reasonable belief or otherwise, is really encouraging searches before officers know anything and then sorting it out later. And, of course, that's not consistent with the law on the exclusionary rule. And I see I have a red light.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you both for very good arguments and excellent briefs. They're always support as we approach these kind of sticky questions. We're going to take a brief recess now so that you all can leave and counsel for the parties and the parties can enter the courtroom. We are adjourned.